You're listening to the Hazard Ground Podcast, with service members from across the military sharing their stories of combat and survival. And now, here's your host, Mark Zeno.
Welcome into the Hazard Ground Podcast. As always, we appreciate you joining us each and every week. Before we get to this week's guest, who is a civilian pilot, joined the Air Force, then went on to fly for the CIA's secret airline and was shot down over Laos. We'll tell his story in just a moment. But first, our normal announcements. As always, please continue to follow us on social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hazard Ground and Hazard Ground Podcast. Our promotion with Amazon still continuing. Go to hazardground.com first. Click on the Amazon button. You can do all of your normal Amazon shopping. We'll get a percentage of what you guys spend. The more you guys spend, the more of a percentage we get back. And then we donate a percentage of that back to some of the charities and organizations you've heard featured here on the show. We certainly appreciate the support, as do all the organizations that are fans of this show and part of the Hazard Ground community. We certainly appreciate you guys helping them out so you can help out veterans wherever you are, just by going to hazardground.com before you go to Amazon first. And then it works the same from your phone, your smartphone. If you go to hazardground.com, it'll redirect it to the app. Credit card information saved. Very user-friendly, very easy. So make sure you go to hazardground.com first to do Amazon shopping. Subscribe to the YouTube channel as well. Like all the content there. Smash that thumbs up button. Certainly appreciate the love as well. Give us a Apple review. Leave ratings wherever you can. Continue to help grow this show and the Hazard Ground community. We certainly love hearing the feedback from all of you. And if you guys ever need anything, of course, you can always email us, producer@hazardgroundpodcast.com. Certainly appreciate you guys staying in touch with the show. All right, now that all that's out of the way, as I mentioned, this week's guest was actually a civilian pilot who joined the Air Force for 4 years prior to Vietnam or anything kicking off, and never actually went to combat as a member of the military. However, after his time in the Air Force, he used his civilian pilot license to get a job as a civilian pilot working with a Teamsters union and some guy named Jimmy Hoffa. We'll get to that story here in just a moment. After that, he went on to Captain Air America. That's CIA's secret airline, a job that he did for 11 years. He was shot down over Laos in 1972 and eventually survived and came back alive to tell the rest of his story. He has a book out now called Flight, an Air America pilot story of adventure, descent, and redemption. He is Captain Neil Hansen joining us here on the Hazard Ground Podcast. Neil, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed this one.
Yeah, you know, listen, I came across your story because of your book, and you know, it was interesting when I first talked about it, because typically, again, I know we have this core of our audience, which I love about them, that, you know, when it's not a specific combat story, they're like, hey, what's going on here? And I try to remind them all that, guys, you know, combat in and of itself takes on many different forms, and there are so many military-adjacent organizations out there that the military works with, that just because they don't wear the exact same uniform doesn't mean that they don't put the same level of danger on the line, the same level of risk and everything else. And some of these covert stories that America never knew, I think, are that we now are learning about are some of the greatest treasures that we've found. So I'm glad that you're willing to share this story as well. But, you know, we start back in the beginning with the military, but I want to know how you got your pilot's license so young.
I was an airport bum at 15 years old. I hung around Detroit City Airport and washed airplanes and got money to learn how to fly. And I ended up getting my commercial license before I graduated from high school or had a driver's license, and went onward and upward from that point.
Yeah, I guess it's easier to fly planes than drive cars. And listen, you might have chose the safer route. They say planes are infinitely safer than cars, so you had a pilot's license before you had a driver's license. That's crazy.
Right, and I had an airplane too.
Really? How did you acquire an airplane?
I saved up my money from washing airplanes and bought a Cessna 140 up in Cadillac, Michigan for $1,300. That same airplane today is almost a quarter of a million.
Wow.
Same year of manufacture. Shows how much the cost of aviation has escalated.
Yeah. You think? I just bought an airline ticket earlier today. I want all my money back. nonetheless, airline travel, man. It's I could do a whole show on airline travel alone there, Neil.
Oh, so yes.
Don't get me started. That said, you decided to join the Air Force then. Why?
Well, airplanes, and I worked with helicopters in the Air Force. for 4 years, and when I got stationed in the Azores, went to London, and yeah, I enjoyed the travel and the different locations, and it was good fun. But towards the end, aviation took me down another path. And in Reno, Nevada, I was flight instructing, flying charter, and I even did radio there for a bit of time. Radio K1, the right one, 1450 on your radio dial.
As far as the Air Force, did you get a chance to get a helicopter pilot's license as well?
No, I didn't. Back then, helicopters were pretty crude compared to what they are today. We even had some with wooden rotor blades, which H5 had that.
Yeah, I don't need to be the Wright brothers and all those people who tried those things way back when. You know, in the Air Force, I mean, what did you learn in the Air Force that kind of stuck with you as a pilot, if anything at all?
Just be careful of what they try to get you to do.
And, what?
Well, sometimes they task people with jobs that were really kind of off the wall. When a helicopter school moved from Edward Gary Air Force Base in Texas to Stead Air Force Base outside of Reno, Nevada, they never took into consideration the difference in altitude. Stead Air Force Base was over 5,000 feet above sea level, whereas the one in Texas was only about 600 or 700 feet above sea level. And the performance of aircraft and helicopters is greatly affected by altitude and the density of the air. And right. They crashed a whole bunch of them trying to move them from Texas to Nevada.
Trial by fire, right?
Yes.
So there is that. What year did you join the Air Force?
1955.
Okay, so we are post-World War II. Kind of Korea is still going on. Mm-hmm. You know, Vietnam is not really anything yet, at least that we knew publicly. You know, covert ops started, you know, mid to late 50s and into the early 60s.
No, in the 40s.
Was it really that early?
Yes. We tried to infill or pick up some agents out of China with a DC-3. And one of the Snotty was a pilot on that thing, and they got shot down. And the two agents that were there to be recovered, Fecto and Downey and Fecto, they got captured and spent 20 years in a Chinese prison until Nixon went to China and admitted they were Americans. They let them go.
Wow. That's a story I don't think a lot of people knew.
And then we lost a crew at Dien Bien Phu, 1952.
Okay.
The French had C-119s, but they didn't have any pilots for them. So they got our guys to fly those, and Wallace Beaufort and James McGovern got shot down over Dien Bien Phu and crashed in Laos. They did go to the crash site, but there's no DNA to identify any fragments that might have been left.
Interesting. The things I'm learning here beyond my scope. They didn't teach that in history class, by the way. I guess what I was leading to in all this was, were you concerned about having to go to combat if you joined the Air Force? Did any of that ever enter your mind?
No, it didn't bother me. In fact, I was brought up as an adrenaline junkie, flying at 15 with airplanes with no radios and the rest of that. And it was a thrill, and it got you hooked.
I guess that's fair to say that's one way to go about it, that adrenaline junkie. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right, so you spend the 4 years in the Air Force. I know you said other things were pulling you away. Mm-hmm. You know, how early or how quickly into your 4 years do you learn that, look, hey, I'm getting out as soon as I get my first opportunity? Or was there a thought you might stay longer?
Yes, no, I wasn't going to stay longer because I could see the opportunity envelope was shrinking. And there was so much available in the civilian world at that time. In fact, before I got out, I even took up skydiving.
If the Air Force had given you an opportunity to either fly planes or helicopters, do you think you would have stayed?
No.
Okay.
Because back then there wasn't a big budget to fly. Most of the pilots in the Air Force had a hard time getting 4 hours to get their flight pay every month. And that was not my desire. I wanted to fly 100 hours or so every month, and I enjoyed it, and it was my life.
So you get out, and the first job you have as a pilot is with the Teamsters Union.
That was, yeah, not the first, but right down the road.
Okay.
And that was a very interesting operation. Flying a Conrad 9800 for Jimmy and crew, and he was on trial down in Chattanooga.
Okay, and so I guess knowing the background of Jimmy Hoffa and sort of what his, quote, you know, job was, what is the allure of going to work for that organization?
Well, he was a good guy to go to work for. He didn't drink, didn't smoke, and don't get caught fooling around with anybody other than your wife in front of him. He was pretty much of a straight arrow. And he worked 18 to 20 hours a day trying to keep a million-man member union together. And the bad part was they were jackals in the bushes waiting for him to stumble and take control of it.
What was your exact day-to-day duties working for the Teamsters Union?
Day-to-day was maintaining the airplane, and I had a co-pilot who did the maintenance on it and also served the drinks in the back and on board. But we flew an awful lot.
I mean, how much? Like, how often and where are you flying on a daily basis?
Flying to Chicago for attorneys that were based in Chicago, and also in Washington, D.C. At that time, the Teamsters Union had the only non-government building on Capitol Square. And from the second floor, I could look right into Bobby Kennedy's office.
Not a bad view. Yeah. This is impressive, to say the least. How old are you when you get this job?
I was 23.
Okay. So 23 and working for Jimmy Hoffa. How long do you do this job?
A year.
A year.
And
because he went
until
on,
he got convicted.
Yeah. He went. We the Italians, we say he went on vacation.
That's right.
Took a trip. He had to take a trip. Mm-hmm. So once he gets, once he takes a trip, do you get like let go, or do you actually just leave on your own?
I left on my own because normally a new regime will change all the players that were privy to the movements and who they were talking to. Which is a wise move.
Right. How long is it before you get the next job with Air America?
I got that before I left, actually.
Okay.
I'd applied in Washington, D.C. from an ad in the Washington Post.
I find this incredibly odd. I mean, you're working for a covert organization like the CIA, who does a lot of stuff in clandestine type environments, and they put an ad in the Washington Post.
Yes, they did.
What did the ad read?
Pilots in Southeast Asia.
Okay.
I figured that'd get me out of the line of fire or back into it.
One or the other, depending on how you look at it, right?
Yeah.
And that's all it said. So you pick up the phone and call? Do you write?
Yes, I called and they sent me a stock application. I sent it back in and didn't hear anything for about a week. So next time I was in Washington, I gave them a call. They were at an office in D.C. and an H.H. Dawson answered the phone and very gruff and said, "We're not hiring right now." And okay, that's a dead horse. And 3 days later, I was in Meigs Field in downtown Chicago, which is no more there. But got a call to come to the airport manager's office and said, "Hold for a call from Mr. Dawson." And he came on the line all cheerful and he says, "Captain Hanson, you still thinking about working for us?" And I said, "Sure." And he said, "I got two questions for you. Can you fly good?" Well, I wasn't going to say the wreckage was still burning, but he said, "One more question is, do you drink a lot?" And I thought, well, I wonder if that's a requirement. And said, "No, sir." And he says, "Can you be ready to go in 10 days? And I said, well, let me know when I'm hired. He said, oh, yeah, you're hired. That's why I called. And I says, how about 2 weeks so I can give them proper notice and they get another pilot? And he says, okay, go back to Detroit. How he knew I lived there, I don't know. But and get a passport and send it to me so I can get your visas. I said, okay. And I did.
That's all it took, huh?
That's all it took.
Wow. Getting a government job now takes like 6 months easily.
Oh, I know.
Being vetted, well, interviewed seven times and whatever. I mean, simple phone call, you're hired, huh?
That's right. Went down to the passport office and took pictures and all the rest of that in. And told him, you know, I need a passport right away. And he said, well, it'll be 30 to 45 days. And I said, well, I'm supposed to report overseas in less than 2 weeks now. And they said, who are you working for? And I said, Air America. And they said, okay, I had the passport in 4 days. That's so that kind of told you there's something funny going on in the back rooms.
Yeah, I guess that's the name to drop. I might try that next time I need a passport.
Yeah.
See if it gets me a little bit more of an expedited manner. So when you take this job for Air America, do you really fully understand the scope of what your job is?
I did before I left. One of the attorneys and one of the last flights I took came up to the cockpit while the co-pilot was back serving drinks. And I said, now I understand you're leaving. And I said, yeah. He says, where are you going? I says, Air America. And he laughed. And he says, oh, yeah, that's the CIA. And so I had great visions of Terry and the Pirates comic strip back in those days and the new James Bond movies that were coming out and novels. And the reality was far, far from that scenario.
So you get this job in 1964, correct?
Right.
All right. Now, you know, Vietnam is starting to ramp up and they tell you you're flying over Southeast Asia. Prior to, let's just say, the first 3 years, between 64 and 67, before things, you know, severely escalated in the latter part of, you know, 67. What's the nature of the missions that you're conducting?
Well, initially, we went to Taipei, Taiwan, and went through Chinese ground school. Mainly because most of the airplanes were registered in China. So that if they were found where they weren't supposed to be, they had plausible deniability. And it went onward and upward from there. And even the airplanes in Laos had Lao registry, not American. So had to get a Chinese pilot's license, Lao pilot's license, Vietnamese pilot's license, Cambodian pilot's license.
Now, forgive my naivete here. This is as simple as if you're flying an aircraft with a tail number, mm-hmm. you know, that denotes that it's from China or Laos, wherever it is, and you land it in Vietnam or you land it in Cambodia, whatever else. I mean, that could theoretically be seen as a hostile action, right? I mean, is that the premise of the whole thing?
Could be, but there was plausible deniability because there was no military on board and it wasn't a military airplane. It was a foreign registered aircraft.
Right. So I guess that's what I'm leading to. Help me understand it. Like it's not a crime to land an airport in an airplane of a different country. So,
right.
You know, how does the plausible deniability, it just comes in as a, hey, I'm just dropping these guys off kind of deal or.
Right. If you were bringing troops in or munitions or things like that, they had plausible deniability that, hey, we don't know this guy. It's not our airplane. It's not an American airplane.
Got it. Okay. All right. So a lot of what you're doing is just moving personnel, supplies. Is it that simple?
Yeah, munitions sometimes. And some of it was against the Geneva Accords, which, of course, that gave them flexibility there. It wasn't an American airplane bringing the bombs in. It was somebody else.
So how do you get a hold of an airplane from a different country where they just basically lied about the origin of it?
No, they didn't. They were registered in China and had Chinese registration and numbers on it and the rest of that. So we had the Chinese license to allow us to fly that. And there again, it's part of the plausible deniability thing. Initially, I flew a DC-6, Southern Air Transport Pacific Division, out of Tachikawa, Japan. But occasionally, they take this DC-6 in Okinawa, at Kadena Air Force Base, tow it over to the other side of the field, strip all the markings off of it. So it was just a bare aluminum airplane. You'd come out at midnight or so and leave all your identification and operations, take off out of Okinawa, fly 10 hours down into Southeast Asia, maintaining radio silence the whole way, flying 500 feet off normal airline altitude so you didn't make a big bang in the sky, offload and come back the same way, maintaining radio silence until you got within about 25 miles of the base in Okinawa. Give them a call and they clear you to land. They paint everything back on it. You'd fly it out the next day with troops on board and Stars and Stripes newspapers.
No, they could turn it around that quickly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a stencil will put the end numbers back on it and everything else. Actually, even a bare aluminum airplane, you could still see where there had been end numbers and stuff on it. So I don't know who the hell they were trying to fool.
I guess it's the effort that counts, right?
I guess so.
Okay. And this is the first part of what you're doing. How long is this going on?
Well, I went on with that for about 3 to 4 months. Then I moved to Saigon, Vietnam.
Okay.
And when I got there, we had 10 airplanes and 10 pilots. So I was on the line as a captain in just a few days. 30 days after that, they made me an instructor pilot. And about 3 months after that, they made me assistant manager flying for Vietnam. And I had several programs that I was in charge of, C-46, DC-3, Dornier 28. Even we had a Piper Apache back then. I was babysitting a whole bunch of new pilots that were coming into the country. That was not fun trying to check these guys out. And plus, it wasn't fun because I was technically on duty damn near 24/7. They had a radio by my bed so that if they wanted to call me out at any time of the day or night for a black flight, as they might call them, and it was not a relaxing job, but it was something I really did enjoy. And some of the black flights that, that you'd fly, which normally for Alpha supervisory pilots, would put you in quite a bit of hazard.
How at what point in time do you start to feel danger? How dangerous is any of this?
Oh, we're picking up bullet holes regularly. Flying around Vietnam because we flew into every site.
I mean, are they just shooting at a plane because it's a plane? Do they actually know what it is?
The bad guys, they knew they didn't have any planes there. So,
well, I guess that makes, yeah. I mean,
we were target practice.
Okay. It's easy to stand out that way, huh?
That's right. And we lost some guys that way, which were sad, but lost a very good friend down in Mekong Delta. And I ended up having to notify the widow and everything else and keep his body secret as far as what had been done to him.
He got shot down?
He got shot down, yeah. He was going down. No, we had Chinese co-pilots. We didn't have American co-pilots. There again, due to the registration of the airplane and all the rest of that so-called stuff. But he got shot down going down a canal outside of Canto in Mekong Delta. And he'd taken a round to his left leg and right arm. And the co-pilot, and he shot out the left engine. And the co-pilot put it down in a rice paddy. But before we could get choppers in there, the bad guys got in and did bad things in the cockpit.
Wow. What was that like for you, seeing the condition of the body and everything else?
Oh, it's not good. It was really a heartbreaker because I known Bill very well, and We played cards together, drank together, and the rest of that. And it was a bad trip.
Was there any part of you that's like, hey, I didn't sign up for this. I don't want to do this anymore?
No. I just didn't. It bothered me, but it didn't stop me.
So is there any part of you that looks at this and goes, well, that's not going to happen to me? Or, I mean, are you sort of deluding yourself into thinking about the reality that that could happen?
It could happen, but I kind of figured I was smarter than the average bear. Adrenaline is a wonderful thing. It makes time stop. Your mind can do 1,000 things. Your body can't move that fast. But if it doesn't paralyze you, you can think your way through this thing. You can figure a way out. And that's the way I used to treat new hires. I'd put them into situations where actually there was no way to escape it. But if they quit and threw their hands up in the air, I didn't want them. They'd go back home. But if they kept working at it, even if they were doing something wrong, that's okay. Just keep working at it. Don't stop and let them kill you.
Yeah. So after this happens and your friend gets killed, do you think twice about any of the missions that they give you? Or, I mean, do you start to have more input like, hey, this might be a better, safer route kind of deal? Or are you still just kind of flying with reckless abandon?
Not reckless abandon. A little more smarts.
Okay.
Watch what you're doing. I never turned anything down in Laos or Vietnam or the rest of that. If it was a hot area, yeah, somebody's got to do it, and I'll do it. But I'm going to try to think my way in and think my way out. Some people would come into a hot area and spiral down over the top of it. Well, that just gives the guys on the ground plenty of time to shoot at you. I'd come in low and fast, pull up, get the load out the back, and keep on trucking. And that worked for me except for one time.
Well, we'll get to that in a moment here. Were there any other kind of major incidents that you could think of or major issues prior to you getting shot down in 1972?
You didn't shot up several times, but and losing people. That was the biggest thing. We lost.
You lost more. How many more did you lose?
Oh, well, overall, we lost over 243 of us.
Wow.
Yeah.
They were all part of Air America?
Yeah.
How big is this whole thing?
At one time, we were almost as big as Pan American.
That seems
it big. Was the largest covert air operation the agency ever had.
I was going to say that seems like a lot bigger than I would have expected. Like that does, I would feel like there's only like a handful of you guys around the world who work in. Obviously, the more people you have, the more loose lips sink ships kind of thing.
Yeah, that was not part of it because the bad guys knew why we were there. They were just trying to keep it secret from the American public.
Yeah, the dumbest group of people. Get it?
not actually. But
we're not worried about the enemy finding us out. We're just worried about the American people and the American.
That's right. Because the funding for this came from a number of different sources.
Right.
The Congress of the United States did not approve covert operations, such as assassinations and things like that. It had to come from companies that were funded by the agency and then routed through the profits into this form of operation.
Oh, God. There's a word to describe that. Dirty is the one that comes to mind, but that's neither here nor there.
No.
And I don't denigrate your work. It's just one of those things where, We're laundering money for the sake of American security, which in and of itself seems backwards, right?
It does. If the government and people of the United States don't want to do it, they should have the option not to do it.
Okay. Then yes, I to an extent, I agree.
Yeah, there's some things that they can't handle it.
I'm with you. Like, generally, I'm with you. Like, not everything the American public needs to know. Like,
That's right.
Part of me, after nearly a quarter century in uniform, and living and surviving through two wars that makes me feel like things are better and easier when we weren't front page news for everybody and everything.
That's right.
Whether that's front page news because of combat or it's front page news because of social media or because of, you know, what they're calling now woke in the military, all that, like all that other crap. Like,
and putting restraints on combat is insane.
Yes. Well, that's
it really is.
The idea that, you know, the rule of engagement isn't survive and bring everybody home with you, you know, sort of defeats the purpose.
That's right. And there's no, you're not going to say, hey, how would they like to get killed? Whatever works expeditiously is great.
Yeah.
Do it.
If you take the tip off the spear, you just have a big stick.
That's right.
That can work, but I'd rather have the spear. So anyway, different geopolitical discussion.
That's right.
Sorry, discussion we can have another day. So 1972 rolls around.
Right.
This is where you get shot down over Laos. Now, take me through sort of a little bit of the context and the lead up. Were things ramping up from the amount of times you were getting shot at, you know?
Yes. Well, back then in 72 and the rest of that, Henry Kissinger was in Paris with the peace accords. And everybody was thinking the bad guys are going to start singing Kumbaya and we'll all go home singing together. But it wasn't true in Laos. The war was ramping up there. They were getting much more sophisticated anti-aircraft weapons and things like that in Laos. And we lost one to Estrella over by Nakhon Phanom on the Laos side of the river. And we lost two more due to the Red Chinese Road that was coming down out of Yunnan province through Laos to Thailand. And they had radar-controlled weapons there. But I was tasked with going down to Paksay, which is in southern Laos, and airdropping to two sites up in the Plateau de Bolivans, which was right alongside the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And there was two fire bases up there with Hmong troops in it, harassing that. And I was tasked to airdrop resupplies to them, more munitions. And you could always tell how bad the area is going to be when you looked at your load. If it was small arms ammunition, claymore mines, things like that, you know the bad guys are right on the wire. If it's artillery rounds, hey, you can make a nice big drop pattern and they're booking those things out and keeping the bad guys away. But this was first line expendables. And first site I dropped at after our choppers, Air America choppers, had gone in and brought the wounded out, had no problem whatsoever. And the next site was only about 15 miles away. And the choppers had been in there and brought wounded out. And some of them stood by while I went in and dropped. But when I overheaded it, the customer on the ground, it was at the site, said, Big Bird, get out of here, AAA. Well, AAA is anti-aircraft artillery, and it comes in a number of flavors. 50 caliber, they had green tracers on those quad 50s. 23 millimeter was white hot and looked like flashbulbs coming up at you. 37 and 57 millimeter anti-aircraft rounds were red hot and looked like red balls floating up at you. Well, I didn't see anything, but I told the two loadmasters in the back, two ties, Sampop and Buma, close it up, and I jinked on the way out and got away from the zone and asked the guys in the back. I didn't see anything. You know, you can see some of this fire. And they said, no, Captain, red balls went by the tail. Well, I knew that was a big weapon down there. And so I went back to Paksay, and the case officer that was in charge of that area said, no, there's no such thing there. And I said, well, how about you go out and talk to my guys in the back? And he decided he didn't want to do that. And I said, well, sweep the area and I'll go back in. But when I go back in, I want some T-28 fighter cover and I want some choppers to stand by in case I have a problem. And he okayed that and I went back. Listen to the choppers going in and out of the site, and they're not taking any fire. So I put it right down in the treetops, hit it right for the site, and had smoke grenades out in the drop zone and a good bubble of smoke coming up. And when I pulled up at the site 400 feet to get enough altitude for the chutes to open, they nailed me. And I lost my ailerons, and it tried to roll to the left into the jungle. And to stop the roll, I buried my right foot in the rudder pedal and pulled the power completely off the right side. And she slowly came back, and I staggered out of there. And one of the choppers says, "You're losing fluids." And the right 700-gallon tank, the cell tank, had been holed, and it was streaming gasoline out of it. And I could see by the fuel gauge I wasn't going to have enough juice to get back to Box A. Plus, I'd had limited control of the airplane. And there was an old Japanese fighter strip there from World War II, and headed for that. It was all overgrown. And due to the lack of control of the airplane, I opted to get the crew to bail out, and we did. And I got my crew out, and on the next pass, I went out, and I watched her impact and blow up. And ended up in some low trees, and a chopper came in to get me one of the Air America H-34s, and he thought he could land in this little clearing, but it was too small and damaged his tail rotor before he picked it up and showered me with branches, and then dropped a sling, and I rode that over to the strip, and he had to put it down because of the vibration, the damage of the tail rotor, and called for another chopper to come in. Well, he did, and landed about 300 meters away from us, and had to carry the wounded over to him, and asked, "What the hell do you do that for?" And he says, "Well, you guys are in a minefield." They couldn't have been very good mines.
But, that's nuts.
The wounded we had filled him up, and they said, "There'll be another chopper coming back for you." And hunkered down in the elephant grass, and everybody had an Uzi. That was what we were issued back then. And waited for the next chopper and got in that thing. Sat over in my canvas seat inside of the cabin of the H-34, and a door opened, and I gave a passing gesture to the bad guys out there, and got to the edge of this Plateau de Bolivans, which is a high mesa, and he ran out of gas. And we're auto-rotating down towards a little village there. We didn't know if good guys or bad guys, but there was dogs and kids out in the village, so as we flared and touched down in a rice paddy, one of our H-34s had been modified with turbines, came out of Cambodia, and he had gun mounts on it and gave me a ride the rest of the way.
Was there a point when you were on the ground that you think that you, did you think you weren't going to get out of there?
No, because I'd done my homework of having guys standing by in case we did have a problem. And there again, when we got nailed, I just kept thinking. And I knew I didn't have any ailerons, which are those big flappy things out on the wings. And I had control via power and peeled the power all the way off on the right side. The co-pilot, he froze. Poor guy. I had a hell of a time getting him out of the airplane. He was scared, and when they finally did throw him out, and he'd seen in the movies how they go in and pull the ripcord going out sideways. Well, you got a metal conduit and a cable there, and it'll bind, and it's struggle doing it that way. You want to grab it and go straight down, and that strips the pins out of the back real well. But he struggled with it for a while and ruined his underwear. And he didn't fly anymore after that.
Part of me thinks that's understandable, but in the same respect, I would defer to your expertise as to whether that was a appropriate response or not.
He was just terrified. He'd had been a full-blown colonel in the Air Force.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but he had a PhD in entomology, bug science, and that's why he got the bird, because of his background and critters.
I didn't know people. I didn't know they gave degrees in bugs. But when I asked you about you not getting out of there, I meant like not your ability to land the plane per se. I mean, as far as, you know, not being found by anybody in Laos or not being, you know, captured or anything like that. Was there any concern there?
Yeah, there's concern, but all of those things, don't let it override you. If it overrides you, you're in real trouble. That's not a thing to dwell upon at that particular point. Dwell upon what you can do and accomplish and without killing yourself.
Was there any level of sadness in watching the plane you were in? Sort of.
Yeah, they were living beings to me. I just really bonded with most aircraft. And if you treated them right, they'd treat you right. And they were your vehicle for survival in the air. And they're real things. And when you take them to their limits, you can almost feel them moan and strain. Same thing you'll find in sailing boats and race cars. You know when things are starting to come apart on that thing. And you try to treat it where you're not going to tear it apart.
After being shot down, you sort of take a break from Air America. Is that right?
Well, Air America was folding its tent in Laos and abandoning the Hmong people there, which had been their loyal fighters for many, many years. And I was very upset over that. In fact, I went ahead and joined a Buddhist monk, a Wat, as a monk, and spent 5 days there with my head shaved and in saffron robes. And it was a great learning experience because they teach you meditation. And that's a double-edged sword. If you can be led many different ways. Jim Jones did a good job down in Guyana. And it's been done with several groups that have prostituted that concept. But it's a wonderful thing, and you can overcome pain and a lot of things with meditation.
So you take a little bit of a break, but you end up back in Southeast Asia a couple of years later, right?
Not even that long. I went down to New Zealand and flew forest patrol tourists and charters and things like that. And then I got a call from a friend of mine in Cambodia. And he says, how would you like to come up here and fly a Convair 440 for me? And I said, sure. Sent me tickets, and I went to Singapore, picked up the Convair 440 there, and took it to Phnom Penh. And Phnom Penh at that time was a nightmare on wheels. The Khmer Rouge had severed all the roads, and the companies that used to truck goods from village to village no longer had any method of transportation. So they bought airplanes. Now, they knew absolutely nothing about airplanes, and sometimes they just bought junk. And it was a walk on the wild side. Phnom Penh was surrounded, and the road between the airport and town had been zeroed in by artillery. And, of course, the airport had been zeroed in, too. When you're out to the airport, they blow a siren, and you jump in a bunker until a round went off or behind some sandbags or laid on the floor, and then went about your business.
That's I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
The Convair I took up there, I lost an engine about a Battambang, which is over by the Thai border in the Cambodian side, and hitched a ride back to Phnom Penh, and everybody wore the same uniform there. So no matter what airplane was ready, you jumped out and you flew it and got a C-46, and it was pretty crude old airplane. It had been rode hard and put up wet. But it shook like hell on takeoff. And I thought maybe it was a tire. But I flew several trips with that, and one to the north of Phnom Penh I landed. And then as I spiraled down over the strip, there was a loud bang in the back. And the Chinese co-pilot I had, he said, oh, cargo fall over. Hell no, I've heard that stuff before. And got on the ground, and the site there was not that secure. the village elders had been all decapitated and their heads put on posts around the airport the birds to feast on. And I walked around the airplane, found a bullet hole with about 6 inches of the fuel selector valve and a right out through the spar, through the top of the wing, and through the cabin, 50 caliber round. Well, that wasn't debilitating for my flight on the way back down to Kampong Sam on the coast. So I got down there, walked around the airplane, and didn't see any other holes. But when I came up to the left engine, it had a Curtis electric propeller on it, four-bladed steel, 15-foot diameter. Grabbed one of the blades, and instead of it being sturdy to lean against, it moved back and forth in the hub. So the whole blade was loose in the hub and would probably leave the scene before long, along with the engine and or wing. So I parked that airplane at that time. And another airplane came available to me. And it was a Convair 440 Anchorwatt Airlines, which was a beautiful airplane. It was a good one. And I enjoyed flying that. But in the meantime, I'd come down with hepatitis.
Oh, okay.
And I went down, before I left Cambodia, I was down to 104 pounds, which was skeleton-like. I'd had to tighten the seatbelt really tight, so I didn't come out of the seat while I rotated the airplane.
So you're in Cambodia during the Khmer Rouge, right?
And right.
That is going on. And, you know, little known, you know, compared to the actual, it's another version of a Holocaust, if you will.
It was.
In Cambodia. And so you were in Cambodia at the time, and basically, you know, Cambodia being supported by the North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, the Pathet Lao, the Chinese Communist Party, all these people were players in this whole thing, but it was a autocratic totalitarian state. And while you're there, all this is going on. I mean, are you starting to feel like you are in grave danger at any point?
Yes, I knew that there was a problem. Kampong Sam was down on the coast. The bad guys did not bother that very much. Around Phnom Penh, yes, they were chucking rounds into the city, into the market, and the rest of that, which was not a fun deal. But this was a relatively decent place. But at the end, I was over in Battambang, where I'd originally come down to fly, lost at Convair. And a friend of mine was there and standing on the ramp, and we could hear a 50 caliber hammering away, firing outbound. And wow, that's not good. And a Cambodian officer came over to us and says, you know, all American, go home. And really? He says, yes, they bring in helicopters, take our government, our generals, your embassy, and all leave. And that meant that these poor guys were out in the boondocks there with nobody to resupply them. So I told my friend, I'm going to go back down to Kampong Sam, and tomorrow I'm going to go to Bangkok. But I won't leave until noon. If you want to join me, then be fine. And he said, well, I'll do that, but I've got to go back to Phnom Penh and get my wife, and I'll meet you there. But I said, be there by noon or I'm gone. And I did. And the next day, went back out to the airport, and the noodle stands that are always around those things and pedicabs started disappearing. And at about 10:30, I told a steward I had on board, and the stewardess, she was only 14, I'm going to go to Bangkok. And he said, oh, good idea, Captain. And they wanted to go in and get their goods out of the hotel. And they borrowed the station manager's Land Rover. And I said, be back here by noon or I'll leave you. And they acknowledged that. And By now, the ramp is gone, empty. Just standing out there looking to the north, the hills where the roads comes down out of Phnom Penh. No dust coming up from dirt roads. So this is a good sign, but the station manager knew that something was up. And I told him, I'm going to Bangkok. And you come too. And he said, no, Captain. My wife, Phnom Penh. Okay, you can't hardly argue with that. But if I would have known that 1.7 million Cambodians would now lose their life in this Holocaust, I might have forced him on board. But you can't do that. And Stewart and stewardess came back at about 11:30 and looked like they were trying out for the Indy 500 qualification and skidded to a stop. And we go, town empty. And okay. Yeah, everybody in town was out hiding now. And I told him, you get on board, and still waiting for my friend. 12 o'clock rolls around, and the 17th of April, and still no airplane on the horizon. So went up the air stair, and it folded into this fuselage like an insect leg, and got in the cockpit. Station manager standing out to the left front and with a fire bottle, and cranked the right engine and cranked the left, and he's still standing there, and he had the habit of saluting when you started taxiing out. I returned his salute. And I have no idea whatever happened to him.
Wow. I mean, obviously this is emotional for you, and it's a lot of years later. And I certainly can understand. I mean, in retrospect, do you feel like, you know, a sense of responsibility to have saved them? Like, was it?
Yes. But don't know if that would have been a good thing or a bad thing.
Why?
Now, I had no passport. I had a suit or a briefcase full of Cambodian reals. Biggest one was a 100-real note. And but the nice thing about that, there was 100 printed in each corner of the bill, and they were green. When I got to Bangkok, I thought we'd get arrested right there. But no, they didn't. So we're all in uniform and walked into the terminal where you got the health check desk there. Guy just waved me through since we're in uniform. And over to the side where the passport and the immigration people were, there was nobody at their desk except for the window on the side. And he looked up and waved me over. Well, I knew this is not going to be pretty, but I had kept an old Air America ID card. And when I walked in, he says, manifest, please. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't have any right now. And I waved my Air America ID card. He gave me some forms with carbons in it, and I filled those out, and we smoked on out. But now the taxi ride in there, since I didn't have any money or passport, I told the cab driver where to go. And I said, you're going to have to take my steward and stewardess and my Filipino co-pilot, who was actually a propeller mechanic. He couldn't fly to wherever they want to go. And had him drop me off. And I had this bill folded up with 100 showing. And I said, now you bring me back change. Well, he snapped it out of my hands and smoked. And I smoked in the other direction. But I went over to a bar there on Patpong Road. And in the bar was Prince Panya from the Lao royal family. And he had his Filipino accountant with him. And he says, where you been? I said, Cambodia. He said, ooh, no good. And he says, you want to fly for me? And I said, sure. And he gave me $1,000 in U.S. bills to refuel that airplane and take it up to Laos. And I did. Once I got up there, he made me chief pilot of the C-46 program that had two C-46s left over from Air America. And I began flying those and dropping rice to villages that used to be enemy. And occasionally into the plain de jars with rice for the people up there. And a soldier would come out with a officer, obviously, with a red star in his cap. And take me over to a tent, serve me rice, cakes, and tea. And always you'd give me a small bottle of Mekong whiskey to take back. I could make three trips there a day. But then they started putting a guy in the jump seat with a red star in his cap and a pistol in his belt. Well, it was obvious that things are going to go south here too. So I bribed a border guard, went across the Mekong River, caught the train down to Bangkok. I'd had enough money to buy a 75% discount ticket as far as Anchorage, Alaska. And went through the boarding ritual and onto the airplane. And he cranked up and taxied out to the runway and boarded the Cold Tour. Came off the ground and was climbing out. And I know I was leaving 243 of the guys there who will always be there. And what was in front of this airplane, I had no idea of where I'd go from there.
Neil, this is the second time here in a very short span where you've been forced to leave behind people that essentially, you know, kind of helped save your life.
Right.
You know, and you tell the story, and I can't help but think of, you know, those visions of us leaving Afghanistan, except there were 800, you know, people on the plane and 200 hanging on for dear life as they got out of there. And granted, for you, you know, coming out of Cambodia into Bangkok, it was only two or three people that you were waiting on that you had to leave behind.
That's right.
A couple of more as you were leaving Bangkok to head back. I mean, are you in those moments? Were you as emotional then as you are now?
Yes.
I mean, let's play devil's advocate for a minute. What would have happened if you would have stayed? Like, what, I mean, how, I mean, obviously in Cambodia, you might have been, you know, you clearly once the murders started happening and the capital killings started happening across the board, just because of the color of your skin, you might have never made it regardless. But what about Bangkok? Was it different in staying there longer? Could you have stayed? Did you? I mean, what was the?
I could, but I didn't really have any vehicle to make a living.
Right.
I was a, as they call a foreigner, a farang. In Cambodia, yeah, there's just nowhere to go. The friend I saw over in Battambang, when he did take off from intending to meet me down there, he tried to get into Phnom Penh, and they started shooting at him. And he abandoned that and went down to Kampong Sam that evening. They were out of gas and spent the night there. But the next morning, there was a little guy with a red star in his cap outside his room. And they didn't kill him. They walked him from there to the Thai border and let him go. But he lost a tremendous amount of weight. We went back several years later trying to find his wife through one of the refugee camps, but never did. And of course, she had a stigma of being a round-eyed wife. So,
how come the time that has passed, I mean, we're coming up on 50 years since 1974. Right. I mean, you know,
right.
How
75, come, that was 17th of April.
Right. So we're 48 years later. How come the wounds are still so fresh, do you think?
They always will be.
Sure.
It's just like when you've been in combat overseas, you'll never come home.
Yeah, we've said that many times. Person you are before combat kind of dies and the new person exists, and you'll never go back to being that person again. It's funny, you know, I said to a girlfriend of mine that I don't remember who I was prior to combat. I don't remember anything about me.
That's true.
You know, I don't remember if I was as high strung as I am now. I don't remember if I, you know, was as disciplined or focused as I am now. I don't remember any of those things. Just a completely different person. But, you know, and similar for you. I mean, look, I guess to a certain extent, you know, there's a lot less emotional damage, if you will, from being shot down and landing the plane than having to take off and leave somebody behind. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Yes. Very, very. Although they were, all the Americans were gone, but the guys that died, they're still there in the sky.
Very much so. Even at this, even after what you went through in Cambodia, and then again in Bangkok, is there ever any part of you that wanted to stop flying and go, I can't do this anymore?
No. Came back to the States, started flying immediately right in Alaska, and ended up after Alaska going down to Guyana, flying in Guyana and bringing stuff into Jonestown.
Did you ever just sit down and fly commercially? Like, whatever happened to, like, you know, New York to Chicago, Chicago to Dallas, Dallas to Atlanta? Is that too boring for you?
No, it is actually. It is. Repetition will kill you.
There's obviously some truth to that. I can't argue with that. You know, when you did what you did for as long as you did, I mean, obviously you're not numb to it now because you're still feeling it, but there's a part of me that's, for lack of a better word, surprised that you didn't grow numb to the idea that your whole purpose in life was to get to someplace, get in and leave. And that was really it. Like you weren't meant to be somebody who was connected to people on the ground for a very long time.
Well, no, in Vietnam, we did not live in barracks. We lived with the local economy. We ate the local food. Same way in Laos, you rented a house and you lived in a house. You were immersed in the local people totally. And you had a bond there. The Hmong were just an amazing group of people. To take them out of slash and burn agriculture into our century, in fact, taking them and teaching them how to fly. Li Lu had more combat missions than any fighter pilot in history before he was killed in Laos. Their motto was fly till you die.
Have you ever had a chance to converse with military pilots from Vietnam?
Yes.
Bear notes. I'm kind of curious.
The only thing is, they were there for a year, and that was it.
Right.
They went home. We didn't.
Yeah, I guess staying there for 11 years was probably, you know, or 9 years, was a much longer deal. And to a certain extent, I guess it makes it harder. But, you know, I wonder if you guys compared notes and what you thought about or felt about possibly the idea of being a combat pilot. Was there anything that drew you to it as opposed to what you had to do?
No, I would have loved to pay back to the bad guys. But we did. We hauled the napalm, we hauled the bombs and everything else for them to, and the artillery rounds, the small arms, the grenades. And it was real to us in that respect, what these guys needed and what we'd bring them. And it was a different life and different existence. You didn't think the way you do out here on the street looking both ways for you for traffic.
Right, right. You know, and again, being so military adjacent, I wonder how much contact you had with a lot of these missions with the military.
I did primarily special forces guys. I've got a very good special forces medic that has retired. And in fact, he came back and used the GI Bill to get his doctor's degree. And he ended up in Brushy Mountain Prison, and he was James Earl Ray's doctor.
Really? Wow. Huh. Such a weird degree of separation.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
Okay. So after in your post-flying career, and by the way, when did you actually technically end your flying career?
Okay. Been a long time, but if somebody pays me, I'll go.
If you got a plane, I'll pay you. That's
well, as you age, your reflexes and everything else decay.
Yeah.
And I know it's people have done that and end up killing themselves. It's just not worth it. Yeah, I'd love to go fly for fun. But it's so expensive now, it's prohibitive.
Yeah.
I enjoy going around and recanting some of my experiences. Yeah. I've been a speaker for EAA for 9 years. And, of course, I do an awful lot about speaking outside. In fact, I'll be going to London, England here the end of October.
EAA, Experimental Aviation Association. You also are speaking at the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, National Vietnam War Museum, the Yankee Air Museum. So sharing these stories, super critical. Now, the book, Flight and Air America's Pilot Story of Adventure, Descent, and Redemption. Descent, when you said that, it makes me feel like you had some sort of fall as opposed to a...
Yes, I did.
...scent. Yes, you were shot down, I suppose. There you go. But what was the impetus for the book? Why did you want to tell these stories in written format?
Well, I did the written format, and I couldn't afford to get it published because it cost money. I was speaking at AirVenture, and there was a lady in the audience that said, you need to write a book. And I said, well, I have. And she kind of regrettably asked, well, I'd like to take a look at it. And when she did, I got a call and says, oh, we got to find an agent. And we got the same agent that handled Stephen King in paperback. And it's gone onward and upward from there with History Publishing. And it's now up for a gold, silver, or bronze medal from the Military Writers Association of America.
That's impressive. Congratulations for
yeah,
that.
We'll know the... I think it's the 16th is when that's coming out.
Of September?
Yes.
Wow. Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed. Hopefully when this airs, that we might have exceeded that date, but hopefully we'll have some good news and an anecdote.
It's going to be one of the three. It's a medal winner.
Okay. That's you just don't know for a second. You're on the medal stand, Neil. So there is right. That. Right? You're on the medal stand.
And even on the back of the book, one of the agency senior agency guys gave me a recommendation on the back of the book.
Oh, wow.
And even Francis Gary Powers' son.
Ah, the B-52 guy, right?
No, the U-2.
U-2, sorry, U-2.
Yeah, his son. He's been here at AirVenture.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Powers' spy plane was shot down, right?
That's right, but he survived.
Right, but that thing was supposed to be like unshoot downable, if that's a word, correct?
Well, they had to shoot down one of their own airplanes to do it. They didn't have a good guidance system for the missiles, so they had to lock onto an airplane down below him, and then that airplane was supposed to shut his engine down and peel off, and then it would get a lock on him. Well, they ended up, well, the guys didn't peel off soon enough, and they shot down one of their own, and then finally they did get the U-2, but he survived, and that was kind of surprising.
Yeah. Anyway, but that's a incredible group of people that you're with. You know, How, in your opinion, how has aviation changed, not only from a tactical standpoint, but just in general? I'm not talking about prices and airports and everything else. But
oh, no. It's a video game now.
Yeah.
There's so much electronic help that the airlines now, they don't really fly them much anymore. The computer flies it. It's sad, and I really got a problem with that. When something goes wrong, unless you've had hands-on experience and time actually flying the airplane, you're not going to be as sharp as what you should be. The airlines just rely mainly on the computer response to an emergency, and that's wrong. Yeah, you got to think too, and basically, most of the airlines, they only make 3 takeoffs and landings a month. The rest of the time, it's computer. Computer does it.
The computer actually does the takeoff and the landing?
Oh, hell yeah.
You don't even have to do what they do on like TV where you pull the lever back? None of that?
Oh, yeah. You're supposed to do that at least 3 times a month.
I might not get on a plane anytime soon here.
That's the scary part about the whole thing. And, of course, at the altitude and the weight they're flying, it's almost impossible to hand fly it. The computer's got to do it.
Huh.
I was lucky enough to ride the Concorde, and that thing was an amazing piece of machinery. The instrument panel was the same as what we used to have back in the day with steam gauges, as they call them now. Now it's a TV screen, and that's what you fly by. And the Concorde was amazing because of all the fuel tanks. When somebody walked from the back of the airplane to the front, it transferred fuel to keep the airplane leveled out. You couldn't use control forces at supersonic speeds and at that altitude.
I might have showed that I'm going to fail physics here. How can you walk when it's moving at supersonic speed?
Because it was a passenger airplane.
Well, that's true. Yes, don't you feel a little bit?
No, you don't. The only scary part taking off out of LaGuardia was when they got airborne. They had to cut the afterburners off, and it felt like you stopped. But that was for noise abatement over New York City.
Yeah, well, you know, taking off LaGuardia is an experience in and of itself. If you like literally leave the ground and you're over water immediately because it's right there.
That's
and you're
right.
Like, we're going to go higher than this or not? Like you look out the window, like, wow, I'm really close to that water. We're supposed to be in the air right now. What's going on?
Yeah, they had to remain subsonic until Newfoundland. Then they could light up the burners again and go supersonic on a curve up to 60,000 feet. And they flew a temperature curve. It wasn't an altitude. The leading edge of the wings at 200-some degrees Celsius. And the airplane stretched in flight because of the expansion of the metal.
Yeah. I'm good. I'll just take a regular old give me my little TV and my headphones and I'll
that's right.
About and forget about everything else. That's amazing. And scary at the same time to a certain extent, because again,
oh, yeah.
I certainly understand, well, obviously never have being a pilot, but you know, the sort of muscle memory and the dexterity and the hand-eye coordination, all that stuff that you have to be able to do a certain task when a computer takes it over for you, those are perishable skills, and they can easily go away, or at least the action method and the timing of it. And in instances, I guess in your world, you know, seconds could be devastating.
Exactly. You got to keep thinking. You want to be several miles ahead of the airplane. That's if you can't stay ahead of your airplane, it's going to kill you. You've got to be miles and miles ahead of it and thinking about what you're going to do then and have that flight in your mind. And that's what keeps you alive.
Are there ways that pilots are better today than they were back when you were flying?
No.
Very succinctly, no.
Fair answer. When we were flying in Laos and in that area, we had no electronic aids as far as navigation or anything else. It was a geometry problem, time and distance, a triangle that you could use for a heading, and you didn't know what the wind was either. And that's what got two of the 123s killed, because the wind blew them up over the Chinese road. And they were in the soup, and they got nailed in the soup. They never knew it was coming.
Yeah. Again, it goes back to same analogy for the military. It's like having a GPS versus actually doing map and land navigation and pulling out
and
your protractor and being able to say, look, if that GPS battery dies or it's whatever reason not picking up a signal, can you figure out where the hell you are and how to get the hell out of there?
That's exactly right.
It's a skill that you shouldn't, you know, as a soldier, you should never lose. But, you know, again, technology can be a blessing, but it can also be a burden. So there
That's
is.
Right.
All right. Again, the name of the book, Flight, an Air America's Pilot Story of Adventure, Descent, and Redemption. It's available everywhere. I assume you can get all your books.
Amazon got it in print, Kindle, and Audible.
Beautiful. All right. Well, look, continued luck with the book and everybody reading it and hearing it and seeing it and all that other stuff. And best of luck with your medal selection here for the Military Writers Association of America. We hope you get a gold medal, a gold star for it. It's an incredible story. I loved hearing it. And to my audience out there who, you know, gets mad whenever it's not an actual combat, it's as close to combat as you're going to get, folks. I mean, hearing those stories about being in Cambodia and Laos were very, very, you know, emotional, but also, you know, as much as combat takes on different forms, that's as close as you can get, man. Leaving somebody behind is a very combat ideal that we don't do. And I'm sorry you had to go through that. And I know it still bothers you all these years later, but I'm glad you're still here to share the story and tell it.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Mark.
Captain Neil Hansen, thanks for being part of the Hazard Ground.
You've been listening to the Hazard Ground Podcast, hosted by Mark Zeno. If you have an interesting story to tell and you'd like to be on the show, send us an email at producer@hazardground.com. And if you like the show, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.